The Geek Cave, brought to you by BuzzTime. Great minds drink alike. Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. And GameStop, power to the players. Hey, nerds. We understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, O searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top-secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
And welcome back to the Geek Cave Podcast movie segment. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm Chad, and the movie segment is brought to you by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. BuzzTime, great minds drink alike, and GameStop, power to the players. Don't forget to join in our quest to help sick kids by supporting Extra Life, our Extra Life campaign. You can find us at geekcavepodcast.com/extralife2017. That's Extra Life 2017. Guys,
I'd like to point out that if it seems like I'm forgetting to mention sponsors or Extra Life or stuff like that during the comic segment, it's because we record the comic segment first thing in the morning, we record the gaming segment right after lunch, and then in the evening after everybody's awake and warmed up, we record the movie segment. So I'm not awake, guys. I apologize.
Literally, nobody was going to say anything, but
yep. You know. I wasn't even going to bring it up.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I'm awake now, so.
Awake and a diva.
Here, have a Snickers.
I will bitch slap you.
So, I considered ignoring all news this month and just discussing Wonder Woman because.
It'll probably take a while, yeah.
Our segment, well, yeah. The movie segment. Routinely runs an hour.
The movie segment is the comic and gaming segment combined, usually.
Which I'm really sorry.
unless I'm talking about crypto.
And the thing is I talk fast.
No,
it's
see,
just the so much.
The thing is though, our sponsors are just getting bonus. They're really getting a good deal. And if you'd like to reach out for sponsorship opportunities, geekcavepodcast@gmail.com.
Well, I decided that if I just focused on Wonder Woman, that would be doing our listeners, the sweetest smelling listeners in the podcast world, a disservice. So we'll get into some news first. On the Cave, you can find it. We posted the Inhumans television show trailer. The first episode is being filmed on IMAX, and after watching the trailer, I think that's their ploy to get butts in the seats. For what otherwise looks like a decidedly boring show.
Yeah.
The only bright spot, the entire trailer, is seeing Lockjaw.
Yeah.
Yay!
Good dog.
Good
puppy.
Alongside a bunch of boring schlock, I found out the showrunner is Scott Buck. Now, Scott Buck has been part of some good stuff. He did some of the closing stuff for the TV show 6 Feet Under, which has one of the best series finales that's been. But he's also partially responsible for the closing seasons of Dexter, which were a massive disappointment, and Iron Fist, which was a disappointment.
My wife and I finally got around to seeing Iron Fist, and it's one of those things where I like Danny. I just don't think he's very smart.
Yeah.
I think the writing was kind of problematic for every character except for maybe Claire, who has consistently across all four now Netflix series for Marvel been the most consistent and likable character.
Yeah. I think we're going to find out she's the actual villain in The Defenders.
Of course, yeah. Night Nurse.
So the early reviews for Spider-Man Homecoming are coming out. We're recording on the 1st of July, so in
a few days.
In 7 days, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming will release to the general public. And Rotten Tomatoes already has 71 reviews up as of this recording. And it's sitting at a comfortable 93%. So that's good news.
It's a fresh spider.
That's good news. Now, we've discussed over and over again that critical reception is not a perfect barometer of quality.
No.
When you consider that all three of us, we enjoyed the Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice movie.
Yeah.
We certainly saw its problems. You know, we understood that, but we were entertained.
I think we all thought that Suicide Squad probably got a worse rap than it deserved as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, problems exist, but it doesn't doom an entire movie. But it helps, especially opening weekends and the second weekend, if the critical response is positive. Because then people are like, well, at 93, I might go this opening weekend as opposed to waiting a week.
Yeah.
Now, in a week when the viewer reviews start coming in, if it tanks, that'll be a different problem. Half of me believes right now that the critical reviews being so positive is just because it's not the Amazing Spider-Man 2 kerfuffle.
Well, and unfortunately, there's a part of me that wonders if it's just getting positive reviews because it is, like you said, under the Marvel Studios umbrella, and there seems to be... The critics seem to be a bit more forgiving of things under the Marvel Studios umbrella that they may not be under DC's. They seem to be.
I can see that.
Because there have been... A perfect example would be the comparison between Man of Steel and Avengers. People died in both of those movies, but you only hear about it in Man of Steel. You never hear about the mass casualties in Avengers. But carry on.
Right. So... Jumanji's first trailer dropped, and we're talking the sequel slash reboot thing.
The Rock is in it.
The Rock is in it. So is Jack Black. So is Karen Gillan.
Looks good.
And Kevin Hart.
Wait, the movie or Karen Gillan?
Yes. No, it does. Movie does. Let me just say, looks good doesn't equate to the movie. Looks good equates to the cast.
Mm.
I don't know about the movie.
I like the trailer. It seems the setup is four high school students cleaning out a basement, find an old video game console that plays Jumanji the video game. Which, you know, there's a Monopoly video game, so why shouldn't there be a Jumanji video game?
Yeah, makes sense.
And they pick their characters, and they get sucked into the game where each of them now has this avatar. So the skinny, asthmatic, nervous kid is now played by Dwayne Johnson.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the...
I hope he pretends to have an asthma attack.
The preppy too pretty to work girl is now played by Jack Black. And you know, the kind of mousy shy girl then is played by Karen Gillan. You know, we've got this very cool kind of setup that very well that has the potential to comment on how we're perceived versus you know, the
who
expectations
really are,
for that our expectations for how we're perceived, for not just how we do that for others, but for ourselves. I hope it takes that on. I hope it engages in that kind of meta commentary. But there's that other piece of me that thinks it's just going to focus on the laughs and the action.
There's going to be fart jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah.
So that Top Gun sequel that we made fun of last month. Apparently it's got a title now and a release date.
Oh boy.
Top Gun Maverick is scheduled to release on July 12th, 2019. Starring Tom Cruise and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. No word yet on Kenny Loggins' music, so when I find out, I'll let you know.
Yeah. No Loggins, no Justin.
That's no Loggins, no deal. We said that. No Loggins, no deal. It's like with the Risky Business thing. No Seeger, no deal. I would like to say right now there is no plan to make a Risky Business remake or sequel.
But now that we've said it. You know, Hollywood really should be paying us for some of this stuff.
They really should.
So do you think if I said, you know, I'm never going to win the lottery, that I'm going to win the lottery next week?
No, just,
because I said it on the podcast.
As long as you don't buy a ticket in Illinois. Jinx.
Okay, so in the last month, we were saddened to hear about the death of Adam West. You know, we heard that. On The Cave, he is known to us as Batman, as the 1960s television show, the 1966 movie Batman. But our younger listeners, who may not have seen those episodes, will likely remember him as Mayor Adam West of Quahog from Family Guy.
Or the Grey Ghost from Batman the Animated Series.
Or Grey Ghost.
Yeah.
Seth
MacFarlane said, or someone from Family Guy said, that there are 5 more episodes featuring Adam West that will be aired over the rest of the year. So look forward to that.
Well, not only that, he managed to get in one more role as Batman. He's going to be in DC's direct-to-video sequel to the Batman 66 animated film.
Yeah,
which
Batman versus Two-Face.
Which features William as Two-Face.
Yes.
No joke.
Yeah, no joke.
No cool. joke. There's no release date set for that yet. I guess it's in kind of
probably next October, if I had to guess. Not this year, October, but the following year.
But in that interview with the Family Guy, I think it was a producer or writer, they went through, double-checked to make sure nothing in that was going to be disrespectful to the West family or to Adam West himself, and they're going to air him. They're going to do it. So Adam West has become almost more icon than actor in kind of geek culture, rightfully so.
Yeah.
He kind of, after Batman ended, it just kind of tanked his career for a while until there was this resurgence.
Yeah, and he embraced it.
Mm-hmm. In the early 80s when they started syndicating old Batman episodes.
Well, not just that, but they released, I still remember this, they released a little documentary promoting the 89 Batman film, but there was a lot of Adam West stuff in there because they were talking about Batman throughout cinematic history, and they had a really nice bit on the 60s Batman. It was called Holy Batmania. If you can find it, watch it. It's really good.
So, and we will miss that dulcet-toned voice spouting such odd, odd things.
Look out!
So dance a Batusi. And here's to you, Mr. West.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to go see Seth MacFarlane live one evening, and Adam West came up and he said that, you know, it's exactly as you would expect him to be. He kind of, the Adam West on Family Guy is a more so Adam West than real Adam West, but he's got that kind of silliness to him and the random things that he says. So it's a shame that I never got to meet the man, because it would have been fun to actually see it for myself.
So, so do we have any other news? Because I know we've got a long review and probably a long discussion.
No, I don't have anything.
No.
Darren, come on. You told me that you had something.
Oh, yeah, you're right. My bad. I'm making notes, trying to be a good producer for a change. So my mind drifted into, like, where do I take out that thing? So, and by the way, that is not something you say on a first date, is where do I take out that thing? Anyway.
I'll keep that in mind.
Backseat.
Under the popcorn.
The financials are out.
In the box.
Speaking of popcorn.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman. Guys, it's doing really well at the box office. How well? Well, it is now the most successful DC film. Period. That is Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. That is Superman Christopher Reeve. That is the Dark Knight trilogy. The most successful as far as domestic take. Not talking worldwide, but domestic take, because I know that some countries are backwards as hell and not allowing this film to be aired or streamed because it has a woman in it. What's wrong with you? But as far as domestically, Wonder Woman, most successful DC film, hats off to you, totally deserved. Hopefully DC takes the right message from this. They won't, but hopefully they do. I don't know, with Geoff Johns in creative charge. It looks like maybe that'll happen.
The problem is we're putting a lot of stock into Geoff Johns' ability to steer creatively.
Well, he made Aquaman cool, so
yes, and he did. And may he continue to do so in such things. What I'm saying is, you've still got directors and actors who are going to do their thing, and you're still going to have studios that Geoff Johns may very well be the creative director, but there's always a boss.
Yeah.
So, well, let's lead into this. All three of us have seen it. All three of our spouses have seen it. Darren and I have seen it twice at least. Justin?
Once. But I wanted to see it again.
We saw it twice because we've been wanting to try out the IMAX theater here in town.
Oh, yeah?
And my wife really liked it.
Yeah, so. I don't have one of those.
Yeah. I saw it first by myself, and that was mostly fine. Then I watched it a second time with my spouse, and there were a group of, like, 14-year-old kids that couldn't figure out where to sit through the movie. And so, once again...
I don't think it was they couldn't figure out. I think they were just being jerks.
So, once again, my theater experience is marred by...
You're just going to have to come to Fort Wayne and watch movies with us here.
Apparently. I said it really does... It wouldn't solve all the problems, but it really does make me want, like, an over 21 showing of these things. You know, let me watch the movie at, like, 6 a.m. Because... Nobody's getting up at 5:30 to watch Wonder Woman. So there are a lot of things to talk about, and we're going to jump right in with our title character, Wonder Woman. How she portrayed, what her character. It's been a month, y'all. So spoiler territory is well and truly past.
Well, and Wonder Woman is one of the metadata tags on this episode. So if you're searching Google for podcasts and you come across us, one, welcome. Two, you know better. You were warned.
So guys, Gal Gadot, she's too skinny. She doesn't have the right chest or hair. She doesn't shave her armpits. How could she possibly be a good Wonder Woman? Response?
Those people are idiots.
Well, that escalated quickly. I was going to go with... She nailed it.
She did nail it.
What she did.
But, like, she nailed it in Batman v Superman.
She did.
And, you know, I think we've said this before. If Michael Keaton and Heath Ledger have taught us anything, it's wait for the film to come out, then tell me if the casting was good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, he was too short. He'd done comedic roles. This is serious. He doesn't have the range for it. Look at that Widow's Peak haircut. Look at those eyebrows. How in the... Oh my God, he's great. So yeah, I think Gal Gadot did a fantastic job. Some people complained about the accent. Again, this we're talking about a woman from an island... A magical island, mind you.
In the middle of some ocean somewhere.
Of impossibly beautiful and impossibly ageless women. And your problem is that she has an Israeli accent.
Boo-hoo.
Yeah. I got a few problems with that argument, but go ahead.
Well, my first response for the people who say she's not believable as a warrior was she served... 2 or 3 years in the Israeli Defense Force.
Yes.
As every Israeli does.
Yeah.
She was a combat trainer. She knows how to kill you. she could kill you with her thumb.
It's very believable, too. she carries herself with such a presence that you believe this is a warrior.
And honestly, if I had to choose the way I was going to die, that would be it.
Death by Wonder Woman?
How did I know that
Death
Justin
by Gal Gadot
was going
thumb.
To say that?
Yeah. Am I that predictable?
You're getting there.
It ug first time. Be gentle.
Oh, shut up.
Really what it comes down to, her character, I think she, whether it's the direction or whether it's her as an actress, really captured the sense of impatient wonder.
Yeah.
Is the phrase I'm going to use here. This, I want to go do something. I need to go do something. This is what we're for.
and at the same time just being awestruck by what's around because it's so bizarre.
Yeah, and I loved how well she was able to portray that conviction and a bit of naivete when Steve Trevor is like, you know, I'm going to take you to the front anyway. You were lying? Just that incredulousness about it. It totally sold me, you know?
It's like, oh, I don't want to be associated with a liar.
Yeah. Well, and just this version of Diana and Wonder Woman is the version of Diana. That is Wonder Woman standing up and calling these generals out on their bullshit. So you're just going to sit here safe and let people die for you, you freaking cowards. You know, the whole, like, the really powerful scene when they're walking to the front and they're seeing chaos all around them. And she is just so torn, and you can see it in her face. I want to help this person. I want to help that person. I want to why can't we do anything? That was perfectly done. It was well done. And then leading up to, of course, the big climactic No Man's Land scene, which, by the way, DC executives did not want in the movie. Patty Jenkins had to convince them to put it in the movie.
The walk across the field?
The walk across the field. That whole thing. They said, why? And I quote, it's not going to be believable. Yeah. Go ahead. Let it out.
No.
Yeah.
I have long since learned that rarely do the studios make the right decision when it comes to creative interpretation.
Yeah. Thank
Sometimes
God.
Sometimes they do. Most of the time, they do not.
Patty Jenkins had to go back and like storyboard this whole thing and give them pictures and a full-on description before they would sign off on it, because they said that they felt it was going to break up the movie. And it was the best scene in the movie, guys.
If not, at least very close
It was the first time that we see Diana in full Wonder Woman
regalia.
It was awesome.
It was inspiring, and y'all should sit in the corner.
Studio executives, you were wrong. You sit there in your wrongness and be wrong about things.
Go feel bad about what you almost did.
So now, as for all of my praise for Gal Gadot, I don't reserve the same praise for Chris Pine as Steve Trevor.
I liked him as Steve Trevor.
I may not know enough. Well, and we're going to just say I don't know enough about his comic character. And that's fine, because it meant that I was coming in and just seeing this one. I kind of, how best to put this? I'm using him right now as an example of what's wrong with the world of men. You know, he may want to do the right thing, but he's so caught up in his version of the right thing.
I would think that that's the point, though.
You think?
I mean, Wonder Woman's whole goal is to kind of inspire them all to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve is, by his own admission, you know, a little bit more than an average man, but he's an average man.
Mm-hmm.
He is the audience analog. This is what men are, the world of man is like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially during World War One. I mean, that time frame.
And I had to assume that it's product of his time kind of thinking, which is good. I'm glad that he shouldn't be a 21st century,
right,
you know, male. But all throughout the movie, I'm just like, you know, if you just explain what you're doing, then everything will go smoother. If you say, well, I have to give this notebook to my superiors before we can go directly to the front because this is my job and what I was sent to do, then we can take the next steps.
Well, he did tell her we gotta go deliver this first.
Yeah, he told her in the backhanded way of saying, come on, woman. You know, stop asking questions.
Yeah. And being a spy, he's probably not prone to explaining things.
He probably is not. However, maybe you should explain things to your rescuer.
Yeah.
Especially if that rescuer has proven over and over again that they're stronger, better trained, and more capable of dealing with a wartime world than you are.
Yeah.
I will say my wife had a problem with Chris Pine simply because she could only see Kirk from the new Star Trek movies. Yeah, she's not a fan of that Kirk, so she had a wee bit of a problem getting past it. But otherwise, she enjoyed the movie thoroughly. So
we get Wonder Woman and Steve out of the way, which is not taking near as long as I thought.
Well, and I liked Steve's compatriots, as opposed to my biggest problem with Rogue One, where I couldn't remember any of the other important, in quotes, characters' names. I remember, you know, Charlie. I remember Sammy. I remember Chief. I remember the ragtag group of fighters a lot better than the other ragtag group of fighters in Rogue One, which was my biggest complaint. They all felt like real people. We learn more about them in the scene that leads up to one of your biggest nitpicks about the movie. Mm-hmm. But we all learn about them a little bit more in that village and throughout the movie, and they are fleshed out as actual characters, and they all have their own motivations, and it's nice to see that. I appreciated that. It was also nice to see Wonder Woman talking with other people that weren't just going to become superheroes in their own films down the way.
Yeah.
Right. Now, speaking of compatriots, I really enjoyed the way that they did that. And I think they were able to do it a little bit better because World War One was such a multi-ethnic war when you compare to World War Two, which when it came down to the color of skin and
three. Well, you've got whites, you've got black, and you've got Asians.
Right.
So,
and so getting to see that was a positive, and seeing how each was pretty much. Yep, that's soldier.
Yeah,
that's the way this is.
That's a meat shield.
I was a little disappointed we didn't see Charlie kind of have his hero moment.
Yeah,
you know,
he didn't really have a redeeming moment for him,
which maybe was part of the point.
I mean, that's not more realistic. Does yeah, not everyone can
and,
come through.
And Sammy comments on that. You know, we don't always get to be the what hero, we want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So going from the compatriots, I'd like to walk back to the Amazon, specifically Hippolyta and Antiope.
Antiope, otherwise known as Buttercup.
Yes. And in my headcanon, that's who that is. See, here's the way this goes. Are you ready for this, Justin? Okay. So a long time ago, there is a farm girl, Buttercup, right? And there's a farm boy, Wesley, that she falls in love with. He goes off and is captured by the Dread Pirate Roberts, eventually becoming the Dread Pirate Roberts, coming back, rescuing her, saving her from Prince Humperdinck, spoilers. And then they all ride away together. So over time, Fezzik, who is a giant, you know, gets word of, you know, where his people are from. Okay? And so now there's a new adventure to go on, and so on and so forth. Well, as they're getting older, they can't do all these things, and they take a ship, and there's a shipwreck. And Buttercup lands on Themyscira, which would explain why she looks so much older
than
the other
else.
Amazons.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because she actually... So she gets to Themyscira. The magic of Themyscira, as it were,
keeps her alive, keeps her from aging any forward. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
So, and this actually applies to all of the Amazons because they were created by Zeus and then brought to Themyscira, right?
Right.
Or put to Themyscira. So all of them are from outside, come to Themyscira, become ageless. Diana, born on Themyscira, you know, created actually on Themyscira, grows up, leaves Themyscira, becomes ageless.
Ooh.
How's that for
Ooh,
fun?
Nice.
So anyway, Buttercup, amnesia, but still has this sense of defending herself and fighting from Wesley, the Dread Pirate Roberts, and Fezzik, and Inigo Montoya, who taught all these different things. And so she proves herself over and over again as capable of learning, and having this background in defending herself, becomes the greatest general of the Amazons.
Hmm. Nice. And you know, Warner Brothers had a hand in the distribution of Princess Bride, and Warner Brothers distributes DC Comics movies, so it could be a shared universe.
Why not?
I love this theory.
It makes the book that Peter Falk is reading to his grandson a biographical account and not just an S. Morgan Stern fiction.
Oh my God.
I'm just saying. It's why Morgan Stern's second book never got fully written. She disappeared.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can't see it, but Darren's mind is now blown.
In terms of Antiope, I am so, and Hippolyta, I am so, so happy to see strong, intelligent women on screen.
Yeah.
I love the direction that they went with across the board with these. I mean, because these are not just, you know, these aren't just politicians. They actually cared for Diana in their own way and disagreed in their own way. Hippolyta, I don't want her to learn to fight. I don't want her to have to do that. Antiope, she's got to.
As an aside.
She might have to fight a giant someday.
As an aside, and back to your theory. So Hippolyta said, I don't want her to fight. And Antiope said, as you wish. But what she really meant, every time she said, as you wish, is I'm going to do whatever I want. Carry on.
Nice. So,
have fun storming the Germans. Do you think they'll take it? It'll take a miracle.
The Antiope as a character made absolute sense to me. She's a warrior. She's a fighter. And here's her, you know, niece, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Who her mother says, no, you can't learn to be a soldier. Well, soldier is what we are.
Well, and when the Germans end up landing on the beach, the smile on Antiope's face as she's leading the charge. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch that the first time I saw it. Caught it the second time. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's nice. That's subtle.
Me too. Yeah. Also, Hippolyta, badass in her own right.
Yeah.
I love it. It's just a very short, like 12-second piece where she spins around and the next thing you know is like there's seven dead Germans around her.
Yep.
It's like, ah, she's not just Whistling Dixie either. It's too obvious not to notice, but the colors on Themyscira versus the colors in London and in the war. I mean, we're making mention of it just because I don't want to get an email saying, well, how could you miss that? I didn't. The colors on Themyscira, bright, vibrant, rich, you know, I can only imagine an IMAX with the resolution that they're able to get.
It was great.
Would just pop like mad, as opposed to the washed out. It wasn't that there was no color. It's just, it was like faded.
It was the Snyder settings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it was, you know, London. Everything was covered in soot.
That's terrible. Yeah, it's not for everybody.
It's a good line.
Yeah.
Really a good line.
Yeah.
But it also was effective.
Yeah.
It was effective. So she's leaving home for the first time. She's the only one to leave home in who knows how long.
Yeah.
That's certainly bound to, you're excited and you're a little scared, a little worried, anxious, nervous, frustrated with the guy who keeps leading you in the wrong direction away from the front because we need to kill Ares. And speaking of which, Ares. Oh, Ares.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Ares, because he's got to go in my nitpick section of the review.
God of War, the twist with the revelation of who he actually is. I applauded it. You know, it was a nice, I didn't see it coming. I'll give it that. It was nice for them to not just go in the obvious direction, that it was obviously German General McGerman. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ares unfortunately falls for the same problem most DC film villains fall for. Pointlessly poetic monologues. In that, you know, it starts off as like, yeah, I'm evil and I want war. And then it goes into, I never made them fight. They fought on their own. And now, Diana, you see the hubris. And he just like starts getting out. He just gets out this book of philosophy and just starts reading it like, man's inhumanity to man is not our fault, but we will change everything. And after a while, it's like, shut up and throw a truck.
Shut up and throw a truck. Yeah. Quote of the episode.
I'm just tired. I'm tired. Hashtag shut up and throw a truck. Which I don't know. First person to give me like a better line than that on Twitter gets a free comic book. Shut up and throw a truck.
Nice.
So I liked. Is it possible to say I liked and disliked Ares?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Catch it. The first time through, but yeah. It took me longer than it should have.
Yeah,
I thought it was actually going to be the general that she tells off that first time with, you know, white handlebar mustache guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was going to be him since he was the one that's like, you know, we send soldiers, they die. That's what they do.
It's Charlie. Picture that as a twist.
Oh, that would be a great twist. No wonder he can't do anything. Ares was not a bad choice.
No.
I can't imagine them doing anything else on the scale that they did.
Right.
Although I would like to see Cheetah.
Yeah, I'd like to see Cheetah. I'd like to see Dr. Poison come back somehow.
I'd like to see her work come back.
Yeah.
Not necessarily her.
Unfortunately, I'm not really all that familiar with Wonder Woman's villains. We both looked at Justin.
Everyone looks at Justin.
Oh, get on the stick. But
who says I'm not?
There aren't as many memorable rogues in Wonder Woman's gallery because she's always been the overlooked character.
Yeah.
I mean, her introduction was exactly. a secretary for the JLA.
Really, for her biggest one is either the Nazis or Cheetah. That's pretty much it. That's how everyone portrays, you know, or fellow.
Yeah,
know,
I mean,
Greek
even
gods,
in Justice League,
pretty much
the animated series, which was phenomenal. Wonder Woman's villains are either Ares, Hades, Cheetah, or someone else's villain. But we'll take Vandal Savage. You know,
or she turns into a pig,
and the villain. Yeah,
good old Circe.
The villain in that one is mostly a slaughterhouse.
Mostly. Whew. It's amazing mostly. How she came back in her outfit.
I know, right?
From the pig thing.
Stupid censors.
Hmm. Oh, we're going to talk about censors later, too. Not in this review. Well, we already talked about censors in this review and how they were foiled.
Right.
So, final boss fight.
It was okay.
The great big airport thing.
It was fine.
Honestly, I preferred the sword fight with the... with vapored up.
Yeah, General McGerman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot his name, so.
Bob not a Nazi.
Big twist, totally a Nazi.
would have been a Nazi if this thing had taken place 22 years later.
I want to see Wonder Woman versus a Nazi, Red Skull. Yeah. Let's just go ahead and do it.
That'd be awesome. But
it was fine. Boss fight was fine. Kind of a bit hypocritical with... you know, I believe in the power of love, which is why I won't kill Dr. Poison, but now I'm going to use the power of love to kill you. But it's fine, whatever.
I did like the godly moment
when
Steve dies and she just kind of,
yeah, and then she destroys everyone. That was that was good. That was on par with when Feyora in Man of Steel just rips through that battalion.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I popped.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to ignore that you said that.
No. It's wrestling lingo for I cheered.
Yeah, that's not what that means anywhere else.
All right, fine.
That, yeah. Yeah, not many people are that big of a wrestling fan, Darren.
So,
anyway.
Go ahead. What are your thoughts on the boss fight?
I was going to say concerning the big boss fight in the end, I was very grateful that when Steve died, he didn't come back. Because, no, I'm serious, because in a lot of movies like that, it's like, oh, he made this miraculous escape at the last second, and everyone's happy. It's like, no, it was war, he died.
Or,
the end.
Or, you know, she uses her new dodge.
I was glad.
Oh.
Well, that would require flying around the Earth in the opposite direction.
So the movie does not entirely take place during World War One. It's bookended in modern times.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought it was one of the more effective closings of the DC movies.
And you can still fit Batman in.
And, well, it's part of what makes it a success. But, no, the what makes the closing work so well in there is kind of the way that she continues that looking optimistically into the future, which doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah, I mean, the 40s were a bit of a downtime, but, you know.
As were the 1918.
Yeah.
Now, you brought up Batman, so I gotta say it.
Do it.
This is the most effective Batman detective story we've seen on film yet. You know, all the time we see Batman beating people up or chasing people down, but not ever actually searching for something.
No, the closest we came was in Dark Knight when he used bullet forensics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so here he tracks down an old World War One era photo from who knows where around the world. Turns out he had it in the file cabinet in the cave, but he still had to go looking for it. Like he had to detect where he had put that.
It's like, is it filed under D or W?
Huh, it's under T for Trevor. What a twist.
It's a twist. So, and we've said over and over again, movies can be great, but rarely are they perfect. So I've got two nitpicks specifically. Do you guys have any nitpicks of the movie that are just... We heard that Justin's spouse didn't like the fact that Chris Pine also played Captain Kirk in a terrible, terrible series of Star Trek movies.
I do have a nitpick, but it may piggyback or be one of yours. So you
the
go
only
first,
nitpicks
and then
I had, I brought up in the Aries stuff.
Okay. So my first one is I could have done with the movie being 2 minutes shorter because the bedroom scene didn't need to happen.
I have a counter argument
for
that.
That's mine.
I'm listening.
And the only counter argument is both Diana and Steve are in this emotionally charged situation.
Mm-hmm.
They both know that tomorrow they very well may die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is genuine chemistry, not just between the characters, but between the actor and the actress.
And I got that while they were dancing.
Yeah.
I didn't need, while they were swaying.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So it's subjective.
I'm just saying it made sense to me.
The entire review is subjective, but
it's just one of those things where she's been built up as this strong, independent woman who can
so a strong, independent woman can't have sex.
Take care of herself.
Well, no.
And no, they can, but it's like she drops. It's like all of a sudden, typical male female trope. Oh, they're in love. Let's go have sex. They really could have just cut it at the dancing.
Now, the second time I watched, I did convince myself that it wasn't the worst thing in the world.
That's because it's not.
It's not. It's really not.
But what does it, what did that is she pulls him in. He's not the aggressor. She's the aggressor in the scene.
I didn't catch that.
He might stay, but she's the aggressor. Granted, she's read all 12 volumes.
Okay, I did not catch that the first time.
And
so
he is not.
And quite honestly, she did say that men are not needed for pleasure. So this is strictly business.
She did say that.
Okay. So,
yeah. You don't need a man
one,
for pleasure.
My other nitpick, which is actually a little bit, it's more serious, honestly, is that at the end with Ares, the big boss fight thing, he goes from sounding like a British guy to sounding like the God of War to sounding like Arthur Weasley. And yes, I know he was Remus Lupin. Don't send me emails.
Ares, the part that kind of took me out of it was that when he did the helmet and he gives himself the eye holes, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. But he kept going so you could see the mustache again. And I'm like, stop.
You're starting to look like the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Quit it.
I don't need the foppish. Just the eyes would have been fine. They're like, no, no, don't you see? I'm still really, really mean. I just happen to be British about it.
You're mean British people.
Like, look, I just threw a tank at her.
Really?
That was cross.
Well, the Brits do make the best villains.
I was going to go with the Russians making the best villains, not the Brits. That would be a conversation for a different day. They certainly make the best Bond villains.
Mm.
Yeah. So,
anyway.
So, it's obviously an A. This is a really good movie. Patty Jenkins nailed the direction on this.
It's the most successful film directed by a solo female.
Mm-hmm.
Because Frozen was directed by two.
Right.
Most successful live-action film directed by a female.
Mm-hmm.
Most successful DC film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it deserves every single one of those accolades.
And the first...
Don't listen to that one guy on Facebook who thinks he's cool by not liking it.
Yeah. Just ignore the bro flakes.
Yeah, bro flakes. I love that
And
term.
The first female hero to be directed by a female.
Yeah.
So that's good news all around. Go see it. If you've seen it, see it again. Just if there's teenagers in the crowd, ask for your money back before the previews and go to a different show. Because young teenagers... In my experience, kind of suck.
You kids.
Do we have other news before this other review I've got?
Well, seeing as now we're 45 minutes into the segment, I have nothing.
I'll talk fast. I'm actually surprised that it's only 45. See, the problem with critical reviews for Wonder Woman being good and our reviews for Wonder Woman being good, we're not having to opposition party. We're not having to argue, oh, they said this part was bad. Well, no, this part isn't bad. This is how it is.
All right, well, with all that being said, if you're ready...
And now, it's time for Chad Savage's Random Movie Review.
Okay, so for those of you who are new, welcome. If you came just for the Wonder Woman stuff and sticking around, hey, thanks. What this year is about, this Random Movie Review thing, is it's about celebrating great movies. And so all the random movies this year are coming from the American Film Institute's 2007 Top 100 list. And today we find number 65, The African Queen. This film, starring Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, was directed by John Huston, who has two other movies on the Top 100, Maltese Falcon and Treasure of the Sierra Madre. The movie is mostly about how amiable Canadian people are and how sex can cause someone to have a complete change of personality that may lead to smiling, laughing, and even treating others with respect.
That's how it worked for me.
The film opens with some of the worst singing put to film as the camera pans to a small mission in Kungdu, which I think is a bastardization of a language that just means come here.
Here, let me demonstrate.
This is not actually an exaggeration. the small mission in Kungdu, the singing is so bad, I can only think that it's to show the ineffectiveness of the missionaries. Because they're either not engaged at all.
Either that or they were protesting.
But the pastor, Samuel Sayer, who's played by Robert Morley, who you don't have to remember, is leading the song, leading in quotes there, the song. The group is singing the hymn Song of Praises, which is a very easy song of praises, song of praises. It doesn't require all that much, and they're just not in it. Singing actually sounds like about 100 didgeridoos at a soccer match. Yeah, it sounds pretty close to that. Fun fact, during this opening scene, it was the later one that they were filming, Katharine Hepburn actually had a bucket just off camera so that she could vomit between takes because dysentery sucks, and I may have misled you by saying fun fact. So into our scene comes Charlie Allnut, a name as funny to say as it is to hear. Charlie runs this tramp steamer that brings mail and sundries. He also acts as a contrast to the two missionaries with his coarse Canadian stomach growling all hungry-like. And that is not actually a joke. Charlie is invited to tea by the two missionaries, and his rotten, plebeian, growling stomach is just so rude that the missionaries, they just can't even.
Seriously, it's so, kind of an awkward scene.
It's really, really awkward.
They can't even so much that they start odding.
Now,
good math joke there. Good math joke.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate it. Now, despite his uncouth stomach, Charlie still declines an invitation to supper with them and leaves. I would have too. I mean, they just talk past him. They ignore him for the most part. While his stomach is growling, the guy, the male missionary who is, quote, leading, end quote, the singing, is looking down at an advertisement to, like, ease stomach gas. You know, like, I think it was supposed to be a joke.
Yeah.
And it just didn't quite land.
Yeah.
But he doesn't leave before telling the brother-sister missionary duo that the war to end all wars has begun, and this is before Wonder Woman gets there, so it's still a big deal.
Yeah, they're screwed. Yeah.
So after he leaves, the two offer this pretty self-aggrandizing prayer to God, you know, that brings swift victory to the British kind of thing. And then the Germans arrive, they burn down the village, they round up the villagers, they apply a rifle butt to the male missionary's face. He has a nervous breakdown from seeing 10 years of work go up in smoke and comes down with a fever and hallucinates before dying. In his hallucinating...
The feel-good story of the year.
In his hallucination, not only does he remember that he's basically really bad at his chosen vocation, but he's also bringing his sister along because she's, quote, not pretty enough to make it in society.
And she hears this because...
Yeah, he's saying it to her.
Oh, of course, yes.
So, now, Charlie had gotten away. He had taken off as the Germans were coming in, so he got away. And when he comes back, he helps Rose, played by Katharine Hepburn, bury her brother before taking her away from the village. Now, Charlie just wants to wait out the war. That's all he wants. Oh, Rose, Rose, Rose. She wants to help the British win the war. How? You may well ask that question. She decides that Charlie's going to use his stores of blasting gel and oxygen tanks to make torpedoes.
As you do.
Because there's a lake that is patrolled by a single German ship, the Königin Luise, which means the Queen Lois, basically. And it's patrolling a lake at the end of the river. If that ship is gone, and the reason that ship is such a problem, that single ship is such a big problem, is because it has a 6-pound gun, which is the biggest gun in Africa. I'd say if you bring two ships, then it can't shoot both of you at the same time.
And if each ship has a 3-pound gun, it's a stalemate.
So, now this is a monstrously dangerous plan. It involves whitewater rapids, a German-held fort, and sinking a 100-foot steamership. Rose, however, is undeterred and browbeats Charlie to help. I would say she convinces him, but she browbeats him.
Yeah, it's not really much of like, this is a good idea. It's just, this is what's happening.
You almost get the sense that she's committing, that she's trying to end her career as a missionary by German.
Yeah.
You know? And what follows for the next hour or so is a combination road movie and odd couple romantic comedy. Charlie, the gin-swilling, aging river captain, and Rose, the prim, proper, teetotaling Methodist missionary, they have their issues and incidents, most of which don't belong in this review because they aren't that funny to talk about.
No.
So as the two make their way through the first set of rapids, though, we get prim, proper Rose, who's at the till. That's the part that steers the boat for all you non-nautical folks out there. And she is unexpectedly stimulated physically. And this is a big deal, you know, that I think we're given the impression that Charlie is using the rapids to scare her away from the plan. And instead, she loves it. She wants more death-defying stuff.
Oh, baby, does she.
We need somebody to shoot at us next.
So would you go so far as to say that she was so happy she popped?
Not yet. But they do continue the mission. And in passing the German fort, and they get shot at a lot, and then they get through another set of rapids, the physical thrill of danger and the relief of safety are such that Charlie and Rosie find themselves kissing, which leads to a fade to black, because you can't show these things in 1951.
No, of course not.
Or 54. I don't remember which. The next morning, we're to assume that sexual congress has been made.
Some heavy petting.
Some definite snogging.
Larow.
Anyway, we fade out from black.
A mission visit to a dangerous jungle.
And Rose's entire personality changes from severe and proper to soft and intimate, bordering on downright familiar. She even asks for his first name. The two eventually form a romantic relationship that anyone in the first week of a relationship will recognize. There's lots of nice words. There's lots of careful choices made to prevent fighting.
Dear baby.
Honey.
Hun.
Rosie.
Doll.
Yeah. And things go on like that. When they go over the third rapids, the boat's propeller and shaft break, because it's a movie, and of course they're going to overcome any difficulty. We get what is the second least believable thing in here, is that they build a forge on shore and fix the iron on the boat, including welding the prop together, creating a new blade for the prop and welding it on.
It's a montage, and if this were an 80s movie, it would have a kick-ass song behind it.
Something by Foreigner, maybe.
Building a boat! That kind of thing.
And because it's a road movie, and road movies are nothing but a series of challenges to overcome in this way, the next obstacle is the delta before the lake. And they get lost among all the islets and have to tow the boat through the mud, getting covered with leeches, getting wiped down with salt, before eventually ended up stranding on the mud. So Charlie, who's been pulling a boat...
He's
tired. A little feverish, maybe.
Probably the leeches had something to do with that.
The leeches might have had something
to do with it. No, that's supposed to alleviate stuff.
No, this is the 1950s, not the 80s.
Rose puts Charlie to bed and then prays that God judge them mercifully and allow them into heaven. So, spiritually speaking, I think Rose has a wonderful growth arch here, because she goes from kind of this selfish, let's kill the baddies kind of prayerful thing to be merciful to us, forgive us where we gone wrong kind of talk. Which, in my opinion, that's a pretty good arch to take. Pose the other way.
Yeah. I love everyone. Kill those motherfuckers.
And we could almost say that God becomes a character in this, because when they're doing things right and proper, good things happen. And when they get all pissy with each other, bad things happen.
So, special cameo by Alanis Morissette?
Unfortunately, no.
No, the rain didn't happen on their wedding day.
Yeah.
So...
That night, the rains come down, the floods come up, floating the African Queen into the lake. The African Queen is the name of the boat, by the way. They don't make that some kind of rosebud thing. That's actually right there at the beginning.
That was the preacher's nickname in school.
Nah. So they make the torpedoes, but in their effort to sink the ship, the African Queen takes on too much water and capsizes, because it turns out that drilling holes in your boat at the waterline and then trying to boat during a storm is a bad idea.
See, because they needed a place to put the torpedoes.
Right. They needed torpedo chutes, which is weird, because all they were doing is basically putting little percussion caps on the end of the torpedoes. They were going to ram the whole boat into the boat they wanted to sink. They were going to sink two boats. What was the plan
here? A twofer.
Interesting.
And what happens instead is that the African Queen takes on too much water and tips over. Rose is assumed dead. He loses her in the storm. Charlie's captured. Charlie doesn't give any information to the Germans, but he doesn't really defend himself either. So as a result, he's sentenced to die by a hanging. As the sentence is delivered, Rose and Charlie are reunited because she didn't die, surprise, and is brought to the great big, the Königin Luise by some other Germans, because there's lots and lots of Germans in Africa, it turns out. And Rose,
yeah, we
then,
like to spread out, you know.
And Rose then proudly confesses the entire plan to the German commander because, well, we got nothing to lose.
Well, I think it's because she gets her kicks on danger. And she's like, what's more dangerous than admitting to a boat full of German soldiers that we're here to kill you?
So for her pride, she's sentenced to die by hanging as well. The sentence is carried out. The final shot is they're hanging bodies on the deck of the Königin Luise. Okay, not really. What actually happens is that as they're led out to the nooses, the German commander acquiesces to Charlie's request for a last request. Just a last request. What is it? Marius. What? Marius.
It would mean a lot to the woman.
It'd mean a lot to the lady. Which leads to the best line in the movie, because the commander does marry them. You know, do you take?
Blah, blah, blah.
To which he says, by the authority vested in me by Kaiser Wilhelm II, I now pronounce you man and wife. Proceed with the execution. Which, truth be told, I think the next rehearsal I go to, I'm going to use that instead of kiss your bride, you know?
Just to see what happens.
Yeah. I may also claim the authority vested in me by Kaiser Wilhelm II.
Oh, please use the German accent, too.
Of course. As the execution is about to proceed, the German ship, which they didn't stop for all this, they're still doing their patrols because efficiency, they hit the capsized African Queen, and it allowing our newly wedded heroes to escape to Kenya, as they say. They don't go to Kenya. They go to Kenya.
Isn't that little grain?
It's just south of Kenya.
Mm. So the movie's fine. You know, the story is simple. The characters are mostly believable. At the time that they were doing this, Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, they're veterans of the film industry. You know, they're in their careers. They know what they're doing, and they nail what makes their characters work. Bogart's Charlie, he's kind of shy. He's uncomfortable around Hepburn's, you know, proper lady-like severe Rose. I mean, it's just, you can tell that he's allowing himself to be bullied rather than stand up for himself.
Oh, he's Canadian.
Yeah. The only part that really failed for me was the transition from antagonism to romance, because it happens as quick as a snap.
Literally, overnight.
Literally. The film garnered Humphrey Bogart his first and only Oscar, although my opinion that's because he was passed over for Treasure of the Sierra Madre a couple years earlier. Which we'll probably watch later this year. Does the film deserve the 100% rating it has on Rotten Tomatoes? No. Is it a great movie that deserves its place on the top 100 list? Yeah. Final word on this is be like me. See the African Queen. It's an hour and 45 minutes. It has some of the giants of the 40s on display. It was in color. It is in color, not was it. In color. It was also shot almost entirely on location. And so this has been the Technicolor cameras were huge.
Yeah.
And so Katharine Hepburn was almost crushed to death by the boiler on the ship because it wasn't bolted down, because they had to be able to move it to make room for the cameras in different scenes.
Oh, well, you know, a true artist dies for their art.
I suppose. So with nothing else to report, we want to remind you to support us for Extra Life 2017 by going to geekcavepodcast.com/extralife2017, extralife 2017. And for the magnificently mustachioed Kent Harris, for Darren Wright and Justin White, I'm Chad Savage with the Geek Cave Podcast. Thanks for listening, and remember, everyone is a geek for something.